The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
The Galway International Arts Festival is on next week, and many of the talks at it are based around the theme of home. You've got people like Catherine Corliss talking about the mother and baby homes. Andrew O'Hagan and John Lanchester will talk about cyber homes. Professor Brendan O'Kelly will talk about his research into Irish mental health in a talk entitled Institutional Homes. And then Tommy Reckenthal will talk about living in a Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. But another person who is making an appearance at the Galway International Arts Festival is our old friend on this programme, the poet Theo Dorgan. He's taking part in a discussion called Home is Where You Start From. And he's going to talk to us a little bit about the importance of how your home sets up your life. So what's your own particular angle?
Well, I got dragged into this because Lucy McDermott and Rona Keneally did a book about different people's ideas of home. A wonderful book of essays by, if you'd say, like primary contributors, and then academics reflecting on home as a theme and so on. It's a very interesting book, one of those new hybrid books that we're starting to see now where scholarship meets the world of the creative arts. And there was a marvellous essay in it, actually, and I'd like to pay tribute to him, by the late Mac Dara Woods, died a few weeks ago, a marvellous poet, but a beautiful, beautiful essay. And a lovely one by his long wife of many years, Eleni Chilinain, whose family were the keepers of the Honan Hostel in UCC. So she kind of grew up in the Honan Hostel. My own thing, I suppose I wrote the piece because I was asked. Lucy McDermott asked me to write a piece. And I have to say, it was one of the most difficult things that was ever proposed to me because, you know, when you share your memory of home with your family and indeed with neighbours and friends, you're really under an obligation to try to get it right. You can't just busk it, you know. And so I wrote about the house I grew up in. My father and five of his friends, they either worked with him in Dunlop's or they were with him in the Pier Shaker Club he was one of the founders of, or both in some cases. They bought a plot of land, divided it in six, and then they were the labour force on each other's houses. They brought in a builder known as the Happy Man, because he was the grumpiest man in Cork, so of course he was known as the Happy Man. And he supervised it, and they did all the heavy work.
They built their own houses for your family.
As a kind of collective. Built the first one, then they all moved on to the second one, then the third one, then the fourth, fifth and sixth.
And where in Cork was this now?
It's right on the northern boundary of Blackpool, Redemption Road. It was a curious place for a lifelong agnostic to grow up because we had the Bishop's Palace on one side. It was North Monastery of unhappy memory behind us and the Diocesan Seminary on the other side. So, but there were fields everywhere. So, you know, we grew up in the city, but we had the whole run of the country as well, you know. So it was a curious place to grow up, very good place to grow up.
How many of you were there?
There were 15 of us.
In a house how big?
Oh, God, not much bigger than the average suburban semi, I'd imagine. But as the younger ones were coming on, the older ones were starting to move out. You know, so I was stopped once, Matt, at a time when everybody in a particular age cohort was being stopped on principle going into the Maggie Mayland. And I was asked, what's your occupation, Mr. Dorgan? And I'd had a rough crossing on the old in this fella, and I wasn't in the best of form. I sort of grumbled, I'm General Secretary to a Soviet of Orphans. And it struck me on the spot that it was true, because by then both our parents were dead. And we did grow up as a kind of a collective, you know, everybody did
everything. So did you sort of oversight and responsibility for this brood of younger children?
I kind of became the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeal and what passed for the elder in the family. But they're all very independent-minded, I'm glad to say. I mean, my brothers and sisters are a fascinating collection of people.
But when you were thinking about it for writing this, and then I suppose this applies in general, how important for all of your future life is the home that you grew up in? I mean, because you often hear of sometimes people have been a bit unsettled, perhaps if they've moved a lot during their childhood, if they've moved from house to house, if they have moved from school to school. How important is it to somebody's formation to perhaps have the one place where they spend their childhood before in adulthood they move on?
It's a question that's occupied my mind for the last 28 years because my life companion, Paula, moved around an awful lot when she was young. And that strongly affects her poetry. And I lived in the same house until my late teens and when I moved out and started living around the city in those famous grotty bedsits of unhappy memory. But the interesting thing is, even though you might say from the outside that I had a very stable home to live in and say that Paula, just to take an example, had a very unstable home background, her imagination keeps going back to the place she was youngest in the north inner city of Dublin, and mine keeps going back to this house. I've had many homes since, and I've made my home in Dublin for a long time. But there's something primal about that first imagination, the first 7 years, I think. And you do keep coming back to that as a kind of touchstone, I suppose. I'm not in the least sentimental about it. It's where I appeared on this mysterious planet that I still don't understand. And it matters a great deal to me because it's the anchor of my imagination. But I rarely, even one of my sisters now and my brother Pat, the Special Olympian, they still live in the house. But I don't feel about it the way I did then. And I think that's only natural as well, because life is as much a series of leavings as it is of returnings. You know, I found when I wrote this essay that I'm going to be talking about in Galway, I found that it was a pristine memory. It was absolutely perfectly preserved. I was able to go back into my imagination and walk in the gate, up the steps. I knew the steps, the texture of the wall beside the steps, what you see when you turn around and you look down towards Murphy's Brewery, even at the shock of the chimney being gone all these many years now. I remember standing in that, being held up in that porch, my father's arms, watching the opera house burning way down on the river. All those things are absolutely perfectly preserved. So I don't think it's so much the physical place itself that matters as home, as how much attention you're paying to it when it is your home.
Yeah, but you've expressed all the details there in the memory. Are your memories of the physical details, or are they of the people with whom you shared the house growing up?
This was one of the more interesting questions. I was able to write, what is it? It's about 5,000 word essay, and about the house. To write about my brothers and sisters, my mother and father, probably take a lifetime. And I'm reluctant to do it. And I've been asked a few times to write a memoir, and I'm very reluctant to do it because it feels like a trespass on other people's rights to their own memories. It might seem an odd way of looking at it.
But it could only be your memory of what it was.
It would be, but the thing is that because of the culture we live in, the memory that makes it way into print becomes the, misleadingly very often, the defining memory. You know, if you think of any of the great memoirs, such is the press of historical time that people think, well, that must be how it was, and they move on because there isn't time to think of everything. But, you know, Michael Yates and Gráinne Yates would have written very different memoirs of their father, and those would have been different again to Roy Foster's magisterial biography. Foster, incidentally, is one of the people who would be in Galway as well. So we're inclined to take a version and then move on.
What age are you now, Theo?
64.
The reason I ask that is, it's very unusual for somebody of your age to still be able to go back to the house in which you grew up. Yeah. Because I'm sure there are many people listening who have moved on. They may have moved a number of times and they've lived in various places. And yes, they may have the greatest fondness for the place that they grew up in, but they can't go back to it now because it's probably been sold on to somebody else.
That's very often the case. But then I think home is portable. I think depending on how much attention you're paying when you're there, goes into your memory and becomes a living source, a living fountain, a living place of renewal. I don't have to go back to the house to still have it, you know. It's like, you know, you might be aware of this, but there's still a stratum in Cork that will forgive you if you go to live in Beijing or Bangkok or Birmingham, but never Dublin, you know. And it, you know, it's dying out, thank God, that mindset. But what there is of it, I found the perfect answer for them. I say, I never left Cork. I just live elsewhere. And anyway, you never leave home, you just live elsewhere, you know.
A couple of things I want to ask you about. I know you're talking about, when's that on in the NUI Galway?
Starting tomorrow, our Nuachtarán is giving the opening address, a meditation and reflection on the theme of home. That's at 10 o'clock. All the events are in the Aula Maxima in UCG or NUIG, as it's now called. You have an extraordinary range of people. You've got Andrew O'Hagan and John Lanchester with their memories of travelling around these islands with Seamus Heaney. You have Katrina Crowe talking to Catherine Corliss, that heroic woman who stuck to her guns and was proved right about the Tuam babies. You have Paula Meehan, Vona Gourke, Rita Ann Higgins,
Martina Devlin?
Martina Devlin. She's a very fine writer. Martina Evans, of course, the poet. And Catriona Crowe, whose idea this whole strand was and who programmed it and has put together a very, very... Oh, one thing not to miss, Lucy MacDiarmid, great friend to Irish studies and a great scholar of The Rising, for instance, and of Yeats. She'll be reading extracts from her forthcoming memoir of computer dating in New York, featuring, among other delights, a toe-sucking amputee fetishist, all the sorts of people she met on computer dating. It promises to be one of the most hilarious books of all time. I've seen some extracts that it would crack you up.
The last time you were with us was because it was a book that you had done for the commemorations of 1916, Towards a New Republic,
right,
the time. Which makes me into, what do you think of this idea of Independence Day for 21st of January next year to mark 100 years after the first sitting of Dáil Éireann?
Well, the first Dáil is very problematic to me, I always think. The salient fact about the first Dáil is not the day that it met, but the way that it unanimously adopted the democratic programme without having the slightest intention of putting any of its contents into material actual form. The democratic programme was drawn up by the Labour Party, essentially. Cathal O'Shannon Sr. had a very big hand in it. It was a sop from Sinn Féin because Labour stood aside in the 1918 elections in order to allow the Sinn Féin candidates a clear run, in return for which they were given the right to draw up the democratic programme. The democratic programme, among other things, said that a primary duty of the state is the care and education and welfare of its children. It put the public good above the private good in all matters to do with property, capital, investment, and so on. I sometimes characterise it as saying Lenin would have hesitated to introduce it in the February Duma, and by the October Duma, it would have been too late. It was very, very radical programme, and it actually proposed a concrete republic, a real republic where everybody was taken into consideration. In 1966, if you go into the RTÉ archives, you can see Ernest Blythe and Sean McEntee agreeing that, of course, nobody had any intention of doing anything about it. It was just the hoist of a flag. And you can see the seeds of destruction of the Republic in that, in those interviews.
So is ours a democracy founded on a hypocrisy?
Very well put. I may steal that if you don't mind. It's that they right from the very start, 1919, the Irish Parliament announced that its standard of practice would be to say whatever they liked and then do the opposite of necessary, or to do nothing at all. So no wonder, as a citizenry, we've come to distrust political programmes and party manifestos. Because right from the very start, it was very clear that nothing would be done about these things, that decisions would be made behind closed doors in the interest of sectoral powers and principalities. And we'd limp on with the kind of empty rhetoric of a republic, but what in fact became a quasi-theocracy and a game of tennis played between the two major parties until very recently. Now, I think 1919 is a very good opportunity for us all to rethink what it would be if we were a republic. And I know it's a drum I've beat before now, but the present context gives it a new meaning, because sooner or later, the Palace of Delusion on the banks of the Thames is going to have to deal with reality. And one of the realities, if they're going to agree on no hard border on the island of Ireland, but no border in the Irish Sea, they will advance willy-nilly the possibility that we will have to manage this island as a single jurisdiction inside the European Union. It's certainly a possibility at the moment. My concern would be that if we were to move in that direction, that we wouldn't be stampeded into it, that we'd take thought and consider what kind of all-Ireland jurisdiction we would like to have it. How would it be founded on principles of justice and mutual respect?
Are we capable of that?
That's a very open question.
Yeah, are there many deep-seated prejudices that still would actually have to be overcome? That for all the talk of equality, that when it comes to it, there are many nationalists who dislike and distrust unionists deeply, just as there is vice versa.
And it would be a very fine judge indeed who could tell how much deeper one kind of visceral dislike is than the other. Of course that's there, but you see, time marches on. It's my private opinion, which I suppose is hardly private if I say it here, but that there's a kind of an internal civil war going on inside Sinn Féin at the moment, between a younger generation that has no experience in, no responsibility for, no direct involvement with the atrocities of the Long War, And they all wrapped the green flag around me. And I think that if only by virtue of the moving of time, the old-fashioned ideas of nationalism, a coercive nationalism, if you like, will die away. I'm not as confident that the equally deep-seated tribal sense of self that the unionist community by and large is. I'm not so sure that will die away so quickly. I'm not sure at all that the South, such as it is capable of hospitality towards the North while these memories endure. But in two generations, in three generations' time, that picture could radically change. I think there is an opportunity here now to revisit the spirit of the democratic program, to try to reconstitute our politics in the South on the basis of constructing an attractive polity, one that will attract people.
Well, how important might the use of the Citizens' Assembly be to that? It may not get a particularly large amount of media coverage in the way that activities in the Dáil do because of the particular political parties jousting with each other. But there are people who would argue that when it came, for example, to the recent abortion referendum, the Citizens' Assembly was way ahead of the politicians in understanding what it was the public actually wanted.
Well, not only are you right, but I'm glad of the opportunity to say that I was wrong when the Citizens' Assembly was set up. My fear was that the government in power, with whatever it would be when the Citizens' Assembly reported, would simply cherry-pick recommendations, fit it to their own agenda and move on. I'm happy to say I was wrong that the Citizens' Assembly had accumulated so much moral weight and such a persuasive set of arguments that they actually led for a short while the political process.
Which was slightly diluted from what was put to the people eventually.
Nowhere near as much as it might have been with a more malign or a more hostile government in power. I don't think we've given enough credit to Micheál Martin, few of whose politics I agree with, but to change your mind so radically on something and to offer as the basis for it your reading of the evidence, that was an extraordinarily mature and welcome thing to do. And I wish more people would follow that example. That may well happen if the Citizens' Assembly continues to express who we are and what we want. The Citizens' Assembly didn't so much lead the political parties, though they did lead them, as give us a sense of what was to come in the referendum.
But in fairness to the members of the Oireachtas Committee that did look at it as well, the whole issue of abortion, many of those changed their position when they spent time examining the evidence, which would perhaps suggest that's what we need. The politicians spend a bit more time doing on many other issues.
Well, you see, the over time, a kind of encrustation has happened on the body of the Republic. A kind of a state political class has grown up, which considers very often just unconsciously that the business of the state is their business and our duty as citizens is just turn up every couple of years and rubber stamp their ambitions and their programs. I think cracks are appearing in that now. And who we actually are and what we actually want is beginning to find its way into the formal political process in sometimes surprising ways. It's the discourse, though, and the way it's mediated to people is still problematic. For instance, Michael D. Higgins has made it very plain that he thinks it's right and proper that there should be an election. But to read some of the newspapers, you think he was being dragged kicking and screaming into it. The man's a lifelong Democrat. He knows that a real mandate will be won if he gets it from an electoral
process. Well, actually, this listener wants to know, would you accept a nomination? With your views and with your thoughts, would you ever consider the possibility as a non-political person?
I think
person?
It would be a disaster for this country.
Why? We have one pot, give it to a pot who perhaps even more standing yourself.
No. Whoever said that now is just having a laugh. No, I think that we've been extremely fortunate in the last three presidents. I put my nail my colours to the mast because one should be honest, I very much hope that Michael D. Higgins is re-elected. But I'd hate to see him just simply rubber stamped in. I'd like to see him come in with a mandate if he gets one. I think he's done a very good job of representing the best of who we are. And he has made his accommodations with people who would have been not very politically sympathetic to him or with whose views he would not have been sympathetic. I think he's grown in office, which is the sign of a mature person capable of taking second and third thoughts. I would have no confidence whatever that I'd be like that, Matt. I mean, you know, I'm a great admirer in principle of the game of hurling, and I'm very dispassionate about it until the Cork jersey appears on the pitch, and then all rationality goes out of the door. I'm pure tribal. Besides, it's not my story. I just want to be left alone to write a handful of poems and make no more enemies.
You should write that memoir. Theo Dorgan, as ever, thank you for joining us. Theo
pleasure,
is one of
Matt,
the speakers at the Galway International Arts Festival, which starts this weekend.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.